This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
For decades, countries like Canada prospered under what we called the rules-based international order. We joined its institutions, we praised its principles, we benefited from its predictability. And because of that, we could pursue values-based foreign policies under its protection. We knew the story of the international rules-based order was partially false. That the strongest would exempt themselves when convenient. That trade rules were enforced asymmetrically. And we knew that international law applied with varying rigor depending on the identity of the accused or the victim. This bargain no longer works. Let me be direct. We are in the midst of a rupture, not a transition.
That was Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney speaking at Davos in January. Is international climate action broken? What now? Political science professor Matthew Hoffman talks us through it. But we begin with the biggest underrated climate killer in America and in many other countries, wildfire smoke. Shocking new science with Dr. Chris Callahan. Plus scientist Sarah Burke, cities are getting hotter faster. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. Let's go. Weather extremes are in the news, but one of the biggest climate-pumped killers is not. Even experts gravely underestimated tens of thousands of people dying annually, not from heat or storms, but wildfire smoke. This is not in some faraway land, but in the United States. Christopher Callahan leads and co-authors numerous studies. His latest work shows increasing deaths in America as climate change goes to 2 degrees C and beyond. This is a story of unmasking the wildfire threat spreading across continents in smoke. From the O'Neill School of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University, Chris Callahan, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
You and I talked in December about mass heat mortality in Europe, and it was pretty shocking. Now tell us about deadly wildfire smoke in America. How serious is it already?
It's a very serious threat. A lot of people have seen the news of major wildfires in places like California and Canada a couple of years ago. I think one really important fact, though, is that most people's experience of wildfire in a warming climate is not going to be because of the direct fire that is in front of them, but because of exposure to the smoke from that fire. Wildfire smoke can carry hundreds or thousands of miles, and it can pollute the air that people are breathing from across a continent. So we know that this wildfire smoke is increasing because of climate change, increasing wildfires themselves. But until recently, we had a pretty weak understanding of the health impacts of that smoke. And so that's the work we've been doing most recently.
Chris, what are some of the ways fire smoke shortens people's lives? Is it just seniors who need to watch out?
I think that's a really good question that people are still trying to figure out. In short, no. Breathing in air pollution is dangerous for everyone. There is no safe level of it. Ultimately, this has been known for a really long time. There is very, very good science going back several decades about the health threats of wildfire smoke and broader air pollution for everyone, but of course more so for people with asthma or other respiratory issues. But in general, everyone suffers when you breathe in dirty air. The research recently has shown, however, that wildfire smoke is becoming an increasingly important source of that dirty air in a way that it wasn't before.
Well, isn't that partly because we cleaned up some of the other pollution in cities?
That's absolutely correct. At least in the United States, the Clean Air Act has been an enormous success. Long-term concentrations of air pollution have been declining, or at least were declining for several decades. But in some places, including in the American West, in places like California and Oregon, that progress is beginning to be erased because of the increasingly common high concentrations of wildfire smoke.
Well, no doubt you've seen recent news on links between small particle pollution and Alzheimer's disease. I wonder, could increasing wildfire smoke lead to more cases of dementia?
It's possible. It seems like every week we see a new study about air pollution causing some other adverse health effect. And so I'm not an expert on the physiology of it, but my general sense is that if you can think of a health problem, there's probably a study showing that air pollution can worsen it.
Well, it's strange. I mean, North Americans grew up knowing that breathing car and factory smog was bad for us. Of course, Europeans know, everybody knows that. But nobody warned us about wildfire smoke. I mean, it seems sort of natural. It happens every summer. Is wildfire smoke as toxic as the industrial smog that we were trying to clean up?
So I think that's a really good question that we don't fully have the answer to. There is some evidence that wildfire smoke is worse than the kind of air pollution you get from a power plant or a car exhaust pipe. Part of the reason for this might be that the types of materials that are burned are different. So in a wildfire, especially one that burns human structures or buildings, you are igniting all of these synthetic materials like the vinyl or the plastic or the other stuff that we make our living arrangements out of. And those toxic materials might be more dangerous than other types. But again, I think this is something that we are currently still trying to figure out that we don't totally know the answer to.
Well, naturally, at the big institutes and the government level, several expert tools have been developed to assess the economic costs due to climate change. But as I understand from your study, these don't yet include wildfire smoke. Why not?
I think for a couple of reasons. One is that the health threats of climate change through wildfire smoke have only really emerged in the last decade or so. This is, I would say, a relatively recent area of understanding because of the very extreme wildfire years that we've experienced in places like California. But this has been only pretty recent. And more broadly, it's just a very difficult problem to address. It requires, to understand these costs, very good data on wildfire smoke, good data on health outcomes, and modeling frameworks that can put all of those things together. And so this is where the science is going now.
When wildfire smoke turned New England skies orange in the summer of 2025, much of that came not from the United States, but from the West and, well, from northern Canada. How did you handle that in your study?
So this is something that our study starts to look at, but I think there's more work that could be done on it. We look at smoke resulting from fires across all of North America, including fires in the United States and in Canada, where we have data on the burned area from wildfires and the emissions of particulate matter that are coming off those wildfires, so we can track how the smoke is moving across the United States, even if that smoke is coming from Canada. But it is absolutely true that some of the most extreme wildfire seasons we've seen in the last couple of years have been in Canada and not the United States. And so I think there's more research that has to be done to figure out how those two different places might generate similar or different impacts.
I took a look at the maps of dangerous smoke particles in the United States in your paper, and the Pacific Northwest looks periodically dangerous for health already. At 2 degrees, a lot of the West is going to be gasping for clean air when the fires are burning. And then 3 degrees C is just crazy, with only the Southeast and Florida keeping smoke-free air. So why did you conclude, quote, 70% of smoke-related mortality comes from states that are east of 95 degrees west longitude? Now, that would be states east of Iowa or Kansas. They're not really in the big forested fire zones. Why are the deaths showing up there?
That's mostly because that's where most people live. So in the United States, most of our population lives in parts of the eastern U.S. and along the East Coast. And so some of the most extreme wildfire smoke concentrations will happen in the western U.S., but when that smoke makes it over to the eastern U.S., it has a very big total health impact just because there are so many people living there to be exposed to the smoke.
You calculate the smoke dose for an average person in the United States for 2 or 3 or 4 degrees of warming. At 3 degrees, which still seems quite likely, Americans on average would get more than 5 times more dangerous smoke particles. That sounds like a public health emergency that could last for decades. Do we need to redesign public health and healthcare for growing wildfire smoke?
I think so, yes. I think this is a public health threat that we absolutely need to be considering. Unfortunately, right now, the government of the United States does not appear to consider climate change to be a public health emergency, but a lot of other governments and organizations are. In the context of wildfire smoke, I think this means we need to think about indoor air quality and air filtration, for example, as high priorities for lots of places like schools and workplaces.
Since the year 2000, scientists and governments try to assess the added cost per ton of carbon produced, and that might help figure out damages and health care and a variety of losses due to climate change. How does including wildfire smoke change that cost per ton of carbon estimate?
So within the United States, we have estimates of how much climate change costs the United States specifically. And when we integrated wildfire smoke into those calculations, we found that it increased the total cost of climate change by about 75%. So almost doubling of the total cost of climate change to the United States. I think it's fair to say that wildfire smoke may be the single most costly impact of climate change that we can currently quantify in the United States. Whether that's the case for other places around the world, I think remains to be seen. But it's certainly the case for the U.S.
How many more Americans will die prematurely, losing years of life due to wildfire smoke, if we get into a 3-degree hotter world?
So our numbers put this death toll at in the range of north of 50,000 deaths per year. So at 3 degrees Celsius, it might be in the range of 60 or 65,000 deaths per year, which is an enormous death toll. And this is consistent with other studies which have shown, even currently, tens of thousands of deaths per year due to wildfire smoke.
And we talked about heat deaths. How do you balance out how many people are dying because of the heat and how many people are dying because of the wildfire smoke, especially since they both may come at the same time?
Yeah, it's a good question. And this is something that we thought a little bit about. Our best estimate is that we have statistical techniques that can control for one and look at the other. So we can look, for example, at how mortality rates rise when there is greater wildfire smoke, then we can control for temperature. So we can say, assuming the temperature doesn't change, all else being equal, how does wildfire smoke affect mortality? And so we've done that so far in our work. But we are still trying to figure out, and lots of researchers are still trying to figure out, if there are interactions or joint impacts that we haven't fully considered. So when you experience a heat wave and wildfire smoke at the same time, is that somehow more dangerous than the sum of its parts? I think that's a really important scientific question that we don't fully know yet.
Your new paper says, quote, based on our estimates, reductions in wildfire smoke and related mortality are likely one of the most important benefits of greenhouse gas emission reductions in the United States, end quote. That sounds to me like a whole new picture, maybe for climate activism, like fighting and adapting or compensating for wildfire smoke damage. It's new.
I hope so. I hope this is something that gets taken up by people fighting for climate mitigation in the United States. This is a fight currently. This paper came out around the same time that the federal government is attempting to rescind the legal authority for federal regulation of greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act. And so I think many of the fights going forward about whether and how valuable it is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions do need to consider wildfire smoke very prominently in that conversation.
With a lot of climate threats, it's usually the poor who suffer and succumb first and most. What about wildfire smoke? Is it balanced like that?
So that is, again, something that we're currently trying to figure out. So far, it doesn't necessarily seem that the poor are significantly worse off. It looks like rich people and poor people alike suffer when the air is dirty, but it is certainly possible that folks with lower incomes maybe have less money to invest in air filtration or air filters. Maybe homes are less well insulated or ventilated and things like that. So I think that's an important thing for us to consider moving forward.
Well, greenhouse gas regulation in the United States is breaking down. Individually, we could make our own communities more fire resistant. We could use masks outside and HEPA filters inside. Can individual action handle this increasing climate-driven risk?
I don't think it can handle it entirely on its own, but I do think it's worth thinking about. Absolutely, if you are in a place that suffers from wildfire smoke regularly, you absolutely should be wearing a mask when you go outside, and you absolutely should, if you can, invest in indoor air filtration. And ideally, we would be doing that in our businesses and our commercial areas and public spaces as well. You can think about this like the way we think about cooling centers during heat waves, where places like libraries or other public areas will make themselves cooling centers because they have air conditioning. We also need to be thinking about clean air areas, right? Places where there is safe, clean air to breathe that you can get out of the smoke for a little while. But ultimately, all of those things are insufficient to fully mitigate the threat unless we also reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
Recently, as published in The Guardian, the European Scientific Advisory Board on Climate Change said adapting to 3 degrees C of warming is, quote, doable for Europe. And you posted a quick reminder that 3 degrees C of warming would set Europe up for heat domes that kill 30,000 people in a single week. And in fact, you studied that in a February 2025 paper called Present and Future Limits to Climate Change Adaptation. What do you think, Chris? Can Europe really adapt to a world that is 3 degrees hotter than pre-industrial?
I'm skeptical. I think we won't know until it happens, if it does happen, although my fingers are crossed that it doesn't. I think it is important to not be overly optimistic about the potential for adaptation. It is certainly possible that some people will adapt. Definitely some people will have air conditioning, some people will have indoor air filtration, but many people won't. And so it's important to be thinking about all of the people who will be left by the wayside and left to suffer if we decide that we are just going to withstand the impacts of global warming instead of actually preventing them.
Looking at some of your earlier work, we hear predictions these days that the hotter El Niño condition could develop even later this year. In 2023, you looked into the persistent effect of El Niño on global economic growth, and that was before the big one of 2023 and the residual heat that came in 2024, the hottest year so far. You found extreme El Niño costs the global economy trillions of dollars in losses, but I'm wondering, is that a lasting impact, or does the economy just rebound with the cooler La Niña periods?
We found that El Niño has these longer-term persistent impacts on the economy. So after an El Niño event, the economies of many tropical countries experience multiple year-long reductions in economic growth due to the sort of legacy effects of the increasing floods, heat, drought, wildfires, and so on that are pretty consistently associated with El Niño conditions. This effect is mostly concentrated in the tropics, so it's not necessarily the case for the U.S. and Europe or Canada, but for many countries around the world, El Niño events do leave really significant economic scars.
Have you found a direct relationship between El Niño events and even worse smoke from wildfires?
That I'm not sure about. I haven't looked at that. There is evidence that in the 1997-1998 El Niño event, there were major wildfires across much of Indonesia, which caused enormous wildfire smoke plumes to spread across much of Asia. And so there is at least anecdotal evidence that that could be a really significant hazard.
If massive wildfires continue to burn in the United States, in Canada, and across Russia, won't that create a kind of burned-out state? I mean, with less fuel left, could wildfires and deadly smoke decline as the century progresses?
So this is, again, a really active area of research and something we're trying to figure out. The short answer is yes, to some degree. When you burn an area, it means you have less vegetation available to burn the next time. And so we did find some sort of protective benefits, actually, of wildfire for future fire. And this is actually why we often want to do prescribed burning or cultural burning in lots of places, especially by indigenous nations who have a lot of knowledge of the ways that fire can actually be a beneficial process on a landscape, right? Fire is natural. It's been a part of our landscape forever, and so having some level of beneficial fire is really important for landscapes to be healthy. Ultimately, though, I think the kind of mega fires that we've seen in places like the U.S. and Russia and Canada aren't really the kind of beneficial fires that we want to be encouraging.
Yeah, we don't want to keep going just till we reach the blacked out planet, because that's not going to be good. Now, suppose humans somehow do take action and manage to hold warming to 2 degrees C over pre-industrial. That would probably cost a lot of money, and it would take commitment by all of us. Would it be worth it instead of keeping the economy going even though 3 degrees is going to be the result? What difference can we make?
I think it's absolutely worth it, and I think the evidence has become quite clear that the health and economic harms of going from 2 degrees Celsius to 3 degrees Celsius are not worth the benefits to production from fossil fuel emissions, right? It is cheaper to mitigate global warming than it is to let global warming continue, and that's because all of the health and economic harms are so severe. And so, and even the harms that we've counted up, when there are many harms that we haven't yet counted up and don't yet know about. And so I think even if you're thinking just from an economic perspective, there is a business case for limiting global warming.
Since your time at Stanford and MIT, you've published a lot of key papers, many of them about relationships between the economy and climate change. What are you working on next?
I'm still thinking a lot about climate change and health, and so the health impacts of rising temperatures are something I'm really interested in. In particular, I want to understand the ways that high temperatures might disrupt healthcare systems. So if many people have to go to the emergency department during a heat wave, what does that do to patients who need unrelated care and who might need to use the hospital for other reasons? Does their care get disrupted when there is a large influx of patients during a heat wave? Those kinds of healthcare costs are something I think we need to be really thinking about.
From the O'Neill School of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University, we've been speaking with Dr. Christopher Callahan. You can find links to all the science we just talked about in my weekly show blog, Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Chris, thank you for spending time with our listeners.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Deadly heat waves are a new fact of life in a warming world, and cities are even hotter than the surrounding countryside. We did not know that urban heat island effect becomes more extreme as the planet moves to 2 degrees and hotter. It is another unpleasant surprise. Here to untangle all that is Dr. Sarah Burke. After a time in finance, Sarah began a serious study of the urban heat island effect in the Climatic Research Unit at the University of East Anglia. Now she's a postdoctoral researcher at the University of North Carolina Data-Driven Lab. Sarah is lead author of the new PNAS paper, Amplified Warming in Tropical and Subtropical Cities Under 2 Degrees C Climate Change. From Chapel Hill, Sarah Burke, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
The fact that cities get hotter than the surrounding countryside, that's been known since the British climatologist Gordon Manley first described it in 1958. Now we realize even that will change as the climate warms up?
Yeah, so actually the urban heat island effect, it was the first time that humans realized that they were impacting the local climate. So it's something that we've known about for a long time, but it's kind of driven by different climates. So if you're in an arid climate versus a really humid climate, the magnitude of the heat island might be different. So it kind of follows that if this is something which is influenced by climate, if the climate is changing, then the magnitude of this heat island could also change in the future.
Well, I don't know. I thought they could just sort of move in lockstep so that if it's 1 degree warmer, let's say, in the whole part of the Carolinas, then the cities will just be 1 degree hotter. But it doesn't work like that.
The urban heat island is essentially kind of a relative effect. So it's a product of both the urban environment and also the rural environment. So something that we're seeing in the future is actually that climate changes can have an impact on the rural surroundings of a city. So if we're looking at the impact of 2 degrees warming on a rural area, that might lead to vegetation changes. So if there's less or more vegetation in an area, that can amplify the difference between the urban and rural areas. So vegetation versus concrete have very different interactions with the climate. So if one of those areas is changing, then the temperature in that area will change in a different way.
Well, yes, why are cities hotter? Is it just the mass of concrete and asphalt, or is there more to it? What are the various mechanisms that make us hotter in the cities?
There's a few different reasons for it. So exactly what you're saying, there's differences in thermal properties. So concrete can heat up very quickly and then dissipate that heat very quickly to the surrounding air, whereas grass and kind of like surfaces with a lot of water retention, it can take them a really long time to heat up. So an example of that would be the ocean. So it can store a lot of heat without its temperature increasing as much. But in cities, concrete heats up really quickly, and then at the night time that heat just radiates out and warms the air. Also, this might be getting a bit too technical, but an important aspect is also the way the heat is transferred. So in rural areas, you typically have a lot of water retention, so a lot of moisture. And when solar radiation heats up an area, the change of state from a liquid to a gas actually takes in a lot of energy without increasing the temperature of that area. So in a rural area, you have a lot of that type of heating, which is called latent heating. The solar radiation shining on that area will not actually increase the temperature as much because it's evaporating water. But in a city, there's very little water retention. So all of that heat from the sun is going into actually heating up the temperature of city surfaces. And then you also have buildings, so those can limit ventilation because wind is not able to kind of dissipate the heat. And you have internal heat sources as well. So buildings giving a lot of heat with the HVAC systems and then vehicles as well. They're also letting a lot of heat out. So there's many kind of different factors which lead to urban areas being warmer than their rural surroundings.
Well, just to nail this down, let's take a case like Raleigh, North Carolina. It's a subtropical city with 500,000 people, I think. And in 2021, a community group measured the difference between downtown Raleigh and the countryside, and they found an amazing 9 degrees Fahrenheit or 5 degrees C extra heat in town. So if the global mean average goes 1 degree, say, hotter than it is right now, how would that city-to-country difference change?
Something that we were looking at in the paper was changes in the land surface temperature rather than air temperature. But if the rural land surface temperature of an area was to increase by 1 degree Celsius, something that we saw in many cities was the additional warming in the city was from 0.5 degree to 1 degree Celsius warmer. So the total change in the urban area would actually be 1.5 to 2 degrees Celsius warmer, whereas the rural area would just increase by a single degree. And that's kind of very city or area specific, so it would kind of depend on the type of climate that the city was located in. So in particular, we saw that the cities in monsoon regions, these are the cities where the urban warming is a lot faster than the warming in the surrounding area.
Before your new study, we did have studies of the urban heat effect in megacities like Tokyo or New York. Why did mid-sized cities get left out, and does that really matter?
Many studies focus on those megacities because they are important. There are a lot of people who live in those areas, and you would expect them to have a very large heat island. But we kind of really wanted to fill the research gap of these medium-sized cities because there's not a lot of other studies looking at them. And these previous studies actually find that in London, for example, the urban heat island actually saturates. So it kind of rapidly increases with urbanization, but then there hasn't been much of an increase in the past few years in its magnitude. So it might be that medium-sized cities and megacities actually kind of have different properties in their heat island. We also felt it was important to look at these smaller cities because currently the grid cells in global earth system models or climate models, they're very coarse. So they might kind of capture the scale of a megacity, but a small or medium-sized city is going to be very much kind of lost in that grid cell in comparison to the more rural surroundings such as grassland or forest or desert, for example.
It would be handy if we ended up with a map or a database where we could look up our own city and see whether we are already as hot as we're likely to get, or at least the difference between city and country is as hot as it might be that saturated point, or whether we have more to come and should prepare for that.
I think that for climate adaptation and human health and comfort in the future, it's really important for us to focus on the most vulnerable populations and because people in cities are already experiencing these higher temperatures, it's kind of really important for us to know exactly how they're going to be impacted and where we should put these adaptations to protect people.
We'll be right back with Sarah Burke.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
The urban heat island effect is increasing. From the University of North Carolina, we go back to Dr. Sarah Burke. Looking at your map in the paper, it looks like cities in the northern hemisphere get even hotter, but some cities, mid-sized ones, in the south, in South America and Africa, see almost no increase of the urban heat island effects during warming. What are the factors behind that, Sarah Burke?
So, yeah, we do see that in our research that some of the cities in Brazil, the heat island is actually slightly decreasing in the future. This isn't necessarily meaning that those cities aren't going to experience warmer temperatures, and they most likely will because their rural areas is increasing. So we are seeing increases in the urban areas, but in these areas, the climate model projections show that there's decreasing amounts of vegetation and kind of climate changes within the rural areas. So what that means is that those rural areas are becoming more similar in temperature to the urban areas. Because this is a relative measure, it just means that the rural areas are getting hotter and the urban areas are not getting hot at quite the same.
Many cities only report temperature at the airport, likely outside the urban core, which may be hotter. And you talked about getting ground temperatures. How did your team detect actual urban heat for this research?
We actually were using satellite-sensed land surface temperature for the exact reason that you described. So a lot of these urban weather stations are actually located outside the city boundaries at airports. And one of the reasons for this was actually because when this heat island effect was discovered, yeah, a lot of researchers realized that they were picking up on this kind of false warming signal in the air temperature measurements because they were actually picking up on the signal of urbanization. So that led them to relocate their weather stations outside of the city areas. Actually, this is something that in my current role, we've been doing a lot of research to kind of find ways to address this, also using machine learning approaches. But a good proxy of air temperature is land surface temperature, which you can observe using satellites. So we use the satellite data from a NASA satellite called AQUA. And we also, in this research, actually excluded cities which were coastal and in mountainous regions. And in these areas, the kind of differences between land surface temperature and air temperature are the hardest to kind of quantify. But in the cities where we looked at the land surface temperature, there's kind of a stronger relationship between air temperature and land surface temperature. So we kind of aim to make our study a lot more applicable to humans in that way.
Your primary research results are based on projected temperatures at 1:30 in the afternoon. And doctors I speak with say when it comes to mortality, nighttime lows are actually as critical as daytime highs. Did you include nighttime highs, and are those expected to change in medium-sized cities if we get to 2 degrees C of warming?
Yeah, nighttime temperatures are really important because we kind of need that time to sleep and recover from the heat of the day. They really are something that is important to look at. We kind of focused on the daytime temperatures for this study, but I completely agree that, yeah, nighttime temperatures are really important for human health.
Talk to us about what your new study means for hundreds of millions of people in mid-sized cities in India and Pakistan.
Yeah, I think that this is really of relevance to policymakers. So I think it just underscores the importance of having heat action plans or really thinking about how these cities can be adapted for people to be able to escape from extreme heat. So whether this means increasing green space in cities or maybe shading structures, potentially retrofitting homes so they have better insulation and they don't get as hot. It really opens the door for targeted mitigation and really focusing on areas in cities where already the temperatures are very high.
Quoting from your paper, it says, in 2018, it was estimated that over half the world's population resided in cities, and this proportion is projected to increase to 68% by 2050. End quote. So it could be even worse with higher heat mortality. Did your study manage to include expansion of cities in the coming decades?
This is something that we didn't look at, was the urban expansion. It's quite challenging to predict how cities might expand in the future because kind of you have to have an understanding of where they can expand into. But certainly the cities that we looked at, which are medium-sized cities, it's very likely that they will expand in size.
What is the data-driven lab at UNC?
So the data-driven lab at UNC is a team of researchers who focus on applying data-driven solutions to environmental problems.
Okay, could you give us an example of a project that you do there?
Yeah, so the current project that I'm working on is a NASA-funded project which looks at exploring disparities and solutions to heat stress in U.S. cities. So part of that involves on-the-ground measurements. Like you mentioned previously, we have a lack of these human-centric observations in cities, so air temperature and humidity measurements within cities. So we're kind of working to address that problem both by collecting data but also combining it with remote sensing data and LIDAR data in order to build continuous maps of air temperature.
You know, I see this new paper as part of a new trend in science. In the early stages of climate study, with less computing power, the best we could do was global trends and very large grids. And now scientists are able to include regional predictions and even specific forecasts, and it's closer to the reality of where we live. Do you see that as a sort of new trend, a new focus in science?
Yes. Exactly. I see that, in particular, new research involving machine learning techniques, for example, can really speed up these very computationally heavy processes. So that's also an advance. But yeah, these climate models, they have to kind of split the entire globe, not just horizontally, but also vertically into grid boxes, and then they run for decades into the future. So that's very computationally expensive, but with computational resources improving and also machine learning, which can kind of reduce the computational expense of these models, I feel like, yeah, we're getting to be able to run more different scenarios and look at different cases.
Do you see a difference in science in using machine learning versus, say, artificial intelligence? Are they the same thing or are they different?
In my experience, I would say that machine learning is kind of falls under the umbrella of artificial intelligence, but the type of machine learning model that we would use is we kind of aim to use models which are interpretable and driven by physical processes that we know are true, so we can make sure that they're kind of behaving in the way that we want them to. And we kind of aim to use models which really aren't too black box, and we can really understand what's happening with them. But I'm not super familiar with some of the artificial intelligence methods, such as large language models like ChatGPT. It's not something that I use, but I feel like they, in my mind, are different types of techniques.
I would agree. You've got a torrent of information coming down from satellites, and it's more than any human can grasp. So you run that through a machine and say, what are we looking at? Whereas artificial intelligence with large language, yeah, you're asking it to be the researcher, and I don't think we're doing that. From the University of North Carolina Data-Driven Lab, we've been speaking with postdoctoral researcher Sarah Burke. She is lead author of the new PNAS paper, Amplified Warming in Tropical and Subtropical Cities Under 2 Degrees C Climate Change. Find links to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Sarah, thank you for spending time with us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. We're in the midst of a rupture, not a transition. That is not cheery news from Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney. He told leaders at the World Economic Forum the old rules are breaking and major institutions, including the United Nations, may not hold. Is this the end of international hopes to avoid extreme climate change? As Matt Hoffman put it, how do we go about addressing climate change without the rules-based order? In Canada, Matthew Hoffman is professor of political science and co-director of the Environmental Governments Lab. That's at the University of Toronto. He published this first look at the new climate landscape in The Conversation. From the University of Toronto, Matt Hoffman, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Great, thanks. I'm really happy to be here.
Why did Prime Minister Carney's Davos speech inspire you to write something?
Well, he really hit on something that I've been thinking quite a bit about for the last couple of months, as the Trump administration has sort of run roughshod over international norms, international rules, international law, and has really seemed to signal that the old way is not going to come back. And it got me thinking that, you know, the old international rules-based order also hasn't been that great for climate change action anyway. And so I had to think, well, what's next? And it was really kind of a profound sense of uncertainty for myself professionally, as well as in my concern about climate change. Because a lot of what we know about how climate politics works, if you think about all the academics working on climate politics and how, what are the obstacles to action on climate change? What are the opportunities for action on climate change? How do governments work together or not around climate change? So much of what we know, so much of what we've analyzed, sort of took the global rules-based order for granted. We said, okay, here's the set of rules that climate action and climate politics is working within. How do we understand where there's opportunities for action, where we can get some momentum? How do we understand where the obstacles to global cooperation? But again, it all took place within this notion of the global rules-based order. And if that is breaking down, well, what do we know? How do we apply or how do we think about where we can go forward? How can we maintain some momentum on climate action? What are the rules of the new order going to be? Where are the parameters for climate action, and what are they going to look like? And so I wanted to explore this for myself because I wanted to see the things that I knew about climate politics from having studied it for the last 20-plus years. What still applies if the global rules-based order starts to break down or is breaking down? And also, where are the potential sources of hope? Where are the potential sources of energy around continuing the momentum or generating more momentum around climate action in the midst of a climate crisis? Because we're not just in a crisis, obviously, of the rules-based order, but we're in a climate crisis. And so how do we move forward in building climate action and building momentum on climate action while we're in the midst of this transition and rupture in the rules-based order?
Right. We may not have lost as much as we think. I mean, after 30 climate COPs, greenhouse gas emissions are still rising. I loved your citation to a 2019 paper by Radoslav Dimitrov. He called it empty institutions in global environmental politics. And Dimitrov pointed to the Copenhagen Accord on climate as just one of many, quote, empty international institutions whose mandates deprive them of any capacity for policy formulation or implementation, end quote. Matt, is the COP process really an empty institution?
Yeah, that's a great article. Ratto has really hit on some really interesting dynamics there. From his definition, it certainly is an empty institution. I'm a little more sanguine than he is about the COP process, but we have to grapple with the fact that if the rules-based order is breaking down, if Carney's correct, then the COP process is going to be fundamentally changed. It is, I would say, undeniable that the COP process has not produced an effective global response to climate change. One of my favorite charts that I always show my class is you can map the rise in CO2 and temperature on the graph and place on that graph temporally, place where the COP meetings and the major milestones from the COP process are, from the UNFCCC from 1992 to Kyoto 97 to Copenhagen 2009, Paris in 2015, and you put those on the same graph, and if you don't understand the difference between correlation and causation, you might say that the COP process was causing increasing carbon dioxide concentrations and temperature. And so it's undeniable that the COP process has not produced an effective global response to climate change. What it has provided is institutional architecture for countries to cooperate or at least to discuss climate action. And what Paris really recognized and what Paris put in place was to say, look, all this global cooperation efforts that we've had for 25 years really depend on countries faithfully and enthusiastically wanting to work on climate change. The United Nations and the COP process was never going to produce ambitious national-level climate action. Right? And the Paris Agreement recognized that. The Paris Agreement says that, okay, we're not going to come up with a collective solution to climate change, but we are going to collect national solutions or national actions on climate change. And the international process is going to be as ambitious as national processes and domestic climate politics and policies are. And that's probably the best we can do until everyone, or at least more countries, are really serious about ambitious climate action. Now, what does that mean in the dissolution of the global rules-based order? It means I think that we probably have to do away with the fiction that global cooperation is going to be produced in the COP process. Right? The U.S. has been a fundamentally bad player in the COP process. I mean, it varies from domestic administration in terms of how seriously the U.S. engages. But it's never been that productive a party to the process. And other countries are just as recalcitrant, if not more recalcitrant, and use the unanimity rules to really block progress. And I think that this rupture in global rules-based system, I think it's an opportunity to rethink what kind of global cooperative process do we have. What are we gaining by having countries that are fundamentally opposed to climate action essentially being able to hijack the agenda? What do we lose in terms of global climate cooperation if it becomes a smaller group that is aligned around climate ambition? These are kind of open questions. But one thing that I think is really we have to consider is if Carney's right, we're going to have to think about different kinds of institutional architectures because there's not going to be the same kind of commitment to multilateral cooperation, however problematic it was in the last 30 years. It's going to look something fundamentally different.
Yes, Carney later says, quote, "We actively take on the world as it is, not wait around for a world we wish it to be." How do you take that?
I think it was in some ways saying the quiet part out loud. It raised a lot of eyebrows. And I think that what I take away from that is that, especially when it comes to climate change, but other issues as well on the global agenda, it doesn't do anyone any good to wish that climate cooperation dynamics were different than they are. It doesn't do anyone any good to wish that there's a rules-based order that sort of treats every country the same. And thinking about where opportunities and obstacles to climate cooperation are going to come from, if you remove that sort of fiction of the global rules-based order, realizing that the disruption to the global rules-based order, or that the rules-based order that is being disrupted, was never all that rules-based, or at least was never as rules-based as it was talked about, and this is where he gets that sort of the fiction of it. And so moving forward, what do we think about in terms of which parts of the rules-based order are going to be best, or should we think about preserving to best move forward on climate action? And which parts of the rules-based order, you know, were never helping us move ahead? And so they were both fictional and not useful. I think that people that are really interested in international collective climate action have some real thinking to do about what is the next order? What should we be pushing for? Not wishing for a return to a system that never really existed, but what are the parameters of international order, whether that's global or whether that is a coalition of ambitious states that then hopefully expands over time, and what are the principles of interacting in that new global order that are going to be best suited to moving quickly and justly on climate action?
Well, just a few years ago, China decided climate change is very bad for China in a number of ways, and they spent large amounts to boost climate research and institutions. I'll bet a third of the new climate science that I see these days has some or all Chinese authors. Do you think, Matt, that will translate into some sort of geopolitical space as well?
Well, it's certainly a possibility, and I think that China has been proactive on climate change, being proactive on renewable energies as having multiple advantages, right? Certainly they are putting a lot of effort on the intellectual side, as you're talking about, but, I mean, China's no surprise, or it's no great news. China dominates the renewable energy sector, and so I think that China has recognized that moving proactively, especially on the renewable energy side of climate action, has enormous upside geoeconomically in terms of China's ability to lead in an important economic sector and to be competitive globally in a major economic sector. I think it sees an opportunity to be a global political leader on climate change. This was an important part of what got us to the Paris Agreement when China and the United States sort of came to a compromise agreement. I think China saw that in important ways as a bit of a watershed moment where they were one of the few major players that could make a major agreement like the Paris Agreement move forward, in addition to the United States and the EU. And it has the benefit of providing domestic advantages as well, both in terms of air pollution and domestic stability, but also the kind of domestic economic growth that has been important for China, both in terms of stability and its economic goals.
So it's not just America denying climate change. Canada played a real bad role for about 10 years under the Harper government, and right now we're seeing anti-science far-right groups in Europe are getting a bit closer to power. What do you think? Why, in the face of obvious disasters, like we just had, I think it was 7 or 8 named storms hit Spain and Portugal in the last month or so, just terrible things are going on all around us, and yet people seem to be driven even deeper into denial. Your thoughts?
Oh, I wish I knew. I mean, I say that somewhat sheepishly as someone, a social scientist working on climate change for the last 25 years, And yet I'm continually baffled by the continued existence of denial. I mean, I can give you reasons for it, but I can't think that I understand it at a sort of emotional level. I think that there is a, and I don't want to also delve into sort of pop psychologizing, because that's not, psychology is not my area, but I think that there's some combination of a fear of change and that a feeling of threatening of a way of life that comes from significant climate action because of the level of transformation that we know is necessary. I think that fear of the unknown, and that unknown generates fear and uncertainty. And for some reason that overcomes the fact that for most people, for many people, the status quo isn't all that great. I mean, we're in the midst of affordability crisis. We're in the midst of food security crisis. We're in the midst of income distribution, especially in the global north, that, you know, sort of looks like the early 20th century. It's not like the status quo is an enormously positive thing for most people, but it's known. So there's that fear of or uncertainty around the unknown and the massive transformation that climate change portends, or climate action portends. Part of the explanation is that there are vested interests in the status quo that make climate action seem as scary and as expensive and as disruptive as they possibly can, because it is in their interest to maintain the status quo. It is in their interest to avoid the kind of changes and transformation that we need for climate change. So those two things interact in significant ways, I think. You know, and politicians aren't leading, and we shouldn't necessarily expect them to lead, but they are just as subject to vested interests and influence from vested interests as people are. And I think there's a third piece of it that goes along with both of those, or why people are somewhat susceptible to visions of it being, of climate action being disruptive and harmful, is that those that are interested in climate action, those that are committed to climate action, those that study it, I don't think we've done enough to sell or to help people imagine what the good life looks like for climate action. What envisioning a climate-safe world looks like, what envisioning a just transition where people live better lives through climate action and better lives through achieving a low-carbon world looks like. We focused a lot on avoiding disasters, and we focused a lot on, yeah, we need significant change and decarbonization. But I don't think that community has done enough. The broad range of folks that are interested in climate action have done enough to generate narratives and imagination around living the good life through the kind of transition that we're in the midst of, whether we want to be or not. And I think that needs to be important work moving forward, because there's a lot of fear and anger to counter right now. To my mind, countering that fear and anger is going to be about focusing on justice through the climate transition and focusing on what kind of a better world we can produce through climate action.
I think we're going to have to wrap it there. From the University of Toronto, we've been speaking with Professor Matthew Hoffman. Find his article, Addressing Climate Change Without the Rules-Based Order. That's in The Conversation, published February 2nd, 2026. As always, I will put links to follow up in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Matt, thank you for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
That's it for another week on One Overheated Planet. I'm Alex. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
The The multilateral institutions on which the middle powers have relied, the WTO, the UN, the COP, the architecture, the very architecture of collective problem solving are under threat.